All right, well, if you're new to us, I've been preaching through the life of King David. I'm not sure which sermon this is, maybe 10, something along those lines. If you've got your Bible, go ahead and turn to 2 Samuel chapter 6. Now, let me give a little bit of a disclaimer. There are some sermons you come to, and you hear the sermon, and it's like balm to your soul. It's like an emotional massage, you know, you feel better, get some of the kinks out. There are other sermons you come to and you feel like you've been through a boot camp class, okay? You're sweating, you feel a little sore, you go, ooh. Well, this is one of those sermons, okay? I'm just warning you, last week was one of those sermons, this week is one of those sermons, next 2 weeks are going to be a massage sermon, okay? So you're going to get it. I want to read to you a few quotes before we get into our text. Now, the first quote's by one of a very wonderful writer named Annie Dillard. I'd encourage you to read her stuff. The quote after that is from God, as recorded by the prophet Amos. And then the last quote is from Jesus. And here's where it says. Annie Dillard says, "Why do people in churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists on a packaged tour of the absolute? Worship is dangerous. Does anyone have the foggiest idea of what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it?" Now, here's God, as recorded by Amos. "I can't stand your religious meetings. I'm fed up with your conferences and conventions. I want nothing to do with your religion projects, your pretentious slogans and goals. I'm sick of your fundraising schemes, your public relations and image making. I've had all I can take of your noisy ego music. When was the last time you sang to me? Do you know what I want? I want justice, oceans of it. I want fairness, rivers of it. That's what I want. That's all I want." And lastly, Jesus, he says, "Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth." This is God's word. So, I want you to think about something. Who's the most famous person that you have ever met? I bet you the people in here have met some really famous people. I think the most famous person I've ever met is Johnny Cash, the late great. Actually sat down and had a conversation with him for about 30 minutes. It was amazing. Who's the most famous person you've ever met? Who's the most famous person you would really like to meet? It's a great icebreaker, isn't it? Now, if you had the time to meet them, how do you think you'd react? How would you react in the presence of someone very famous, very important, very powerful and accomplished? One of my mentors tells a story that he experienced. He was with a group of pastors who had the occasion to meet the President of the United States. Now, you would think that a group of ministers would have some sense of decorum and would have an idea of how to conduct themselves in such a meeting. But he said, in our group, there was one younger minister in particular that seemed totally lost in the moment. He said, "We were ushered by the Secret Service down the halls of the White House, and we began to walk by the portraits of past presidents. And then we began to walk by the different offices where you had the Secretary of the Interior and of Defense and of the Secretary of State. And it was this magnificent display meant to conjure up an overwhelming sense of awe and majesty. And as they continued to walk down the hallway that funneled them into the office of the most powerful man in the entire world, this young pastor got totally lost in the significance of the moment. And he said this guy kept muttering out loud, "Oh, wow! Oh, wow! We look at that! Oh, wow!" And it got worse. He said they walked into the Oval Office to meet the president, and this guy conducted himself with all the dignity of a preteen girl at a Justin Bieber concert. And so when he went to shake hands with the president, he just kept looking at him. He didn't say his name. He just went, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, I can't believe it's you, and you're in person, oh, wow." Now, on the other extreme in the same group, there was another minister. And he was sort of in the back, nervously pacing back and forth, scowl on his face, never even bothered to go up and meet the president and shake his hand. So my friend said, "Don't you want to go meet the president? Don't you want to go shake hands?" And the guy said, "Did you see that other idiot up there? I'm so embarrassed. And I'm not going to put myself in a situation to possibly make a fool out of myself like he did." And on one hand, he was right. The first man had obviously made a fool out of himself. In all the thrill and all the excitement and all the hoopla, he got caught up in the emotion of the moment and he forgot to even introduce himself. He lost his head. But the other man was equally off balance. In saying, "I'm not going to make a fool out of myself like that," he was being incredibly arrogant. And because of his fear of embarrassment and his desire to be overly dignified, he missed the opportunity of a lifetime to meet and speak to the President of the United States. You could say he lost his heart. One man lost his head. The other man lost his heart. So if you had the opportunity to meet someone really famous, really powerful, really important, how would you react? That's a really important question. Because every Sunday morning we come to worship. And we have access to and an audience with the most powerful, the most important, and the most famous being of all, the creator of the entire universe, the maker of heaven and earth, the great sovereign king of glory, the judge and savior of all mankind who holds life and death in his hands. And like the story I told, we too can lose our heads in excitement and emotion, or we can withdraw, becoming disconnected observers, judging things, critiquing, in fear of embarrassing ourselves. And we end up losing heart for what we're doing. So this morning, as we look at 2 Samuel chapter 6, we're going to learn about worshiping God. 2 Samuel 6 is a story about worshiping God. And it's in this chapter we have three portraits of three people. And I think these three portraits, when you piece them together, they form a very helpful paradigm of what it means to worship. What it means to worship and how we are called to participate in worship. And what we see, as you could probably guess it from my little story, we first see someone who loses their head. We next see someone who loses their heart. And then in David, we see a picture of someone who gave his head and surrendered his heart. Okay? Let me give you a little bit of context. So last week, we talked about David and dirty politics around the civil war in Israel. Okay? Some years have passed. Israel has come together and united under David's kingship. David's 40 years old. And right before the story we're going to read happened, the Philistines had come and captured the Ark of the Covenant from Israel. Now, this is not Noah's Ark. This is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Okay, it's that Ark. And this ark was a wooden box that was covered with gold. It was like 4 feet tall, 2 feet wide, 2 feet deep. The lid on it was solid gold. It was called the mercy seat. And above it were these two cherubim whose wings formed the mercy seat. And inside of the ark, there were three things. There were the tablets of the Ten Commandments. There was a piece of manna. And there was Aaron's staff that he used. Now, the ark didn't have magical properties. In fact, every time the Israelites would try to use it like a good luck charm, God would judge them for it. It wasn't like you rubbed the side of it and a genie popped out. But the ark served as a reminder that God had worked in the history of Israel and continues to work. It showed that God was not an impersonal idea, but he was personal in the history of Israel. He was creating, he was directing, he was saving. That God entered the affairs of men and women, and when he did, he judged and he saved. He called to account and he blessed. Most of all, he loved and he wanted to be with his people. And so this ark kept all this before them, and the purpose was to remind them of their God. And it wasn't like a piece of memorabilia, but it was a display of what had happened and what is happening. It's all about God's presence and his actions to save. Probably the closest thing we have to that today is the sacraments of baptism and communion. Well, with that being said, I'm going to look at the first five verses of 2 Samuel chapter 6. And this is what it says. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Baalah of Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. They set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Now that's important. Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with songs and with harps and lyres and tambourines and cisterns and cymbals. Okay, David and the people of Israel were just ecstatic beyond words. This box represented the power and presence of God, and it had been absent for many years. The Philistines had stolen it. They'd finally gotten it back. And it was very important, now that David was king, that he bring the ark back to Jerusalem with him, because it was to show that the ultimate ruler of Israel is not David, it is God. And so there's going to be a celebration, and you've got 30,000 men, plus women, plus children, all these people gathered together to have a rocking, massive worship service. They're bringing the Ark of God into Jerusalem. We finally got a new king. So the air was electric with excitement and anticipation and hope. It's like a ticker tape parade going down Fifth Avenue in New York City. God had been so faithful to Israel. Finally, they were united under a strong leader who made God the unavoidable issue. And so, blessings began to cascade like a river of raging joy into Israel, and hearts were being renewed and lives were being changed, and they were entering into a golden age of military and economic prosperity. And so, in verse 5, we read that David is leading the crowd, and I mean, they got all the instruments. I mean, it is like, what? I mean, they're knocking it out, right? They're giving to themselves to the occasion. And you got to admire that. I mean, I wish we could learn how to worship God like that. That's hard for Presbyterians. To be passionate. To be deeply engaged. And I know Presbyterians can do it because I've watched football games with y'all. I've seen emotion. So I know we can. I've seen you talk about politics. I know you can get emotional. So you admire the passion, but that wasn't the whole story. Because if you know your Old Testament, as I read that, you know there's something here that's really, really, really wrong. in this excitement, a major problem happened. And we see it in verses 3 and 4, where they say they set the ark of God on a new cart. And I'm sure it was a nice cart. It was probably a Bentley or a Rolls Royce cart, right? It was at the house of Abinadab, which was on a hill. So it's going downhill. And these two guys who were sons of Abinadab, Uzzah and Ahio, they were guiding the cart with the ark on it. Now, you read that and you think, well, that's not a big deal, is it? I mean, it's a new cart. They didn't go to Shalom's used cart dealership in a seedy part of Jerusalem to get it. But that was not the way they were supposed to deal with the Ark of the Covenant. And I think there were good motivations. But nobody bothered to consult God about how he was worshipped. And God was not nearly as laid back and unconcerned with how people worshipped him as they were. What they were doing was completely out of alignment with how God prescribed that he be worshipped. And so just for context, if you want to know something about the ark had these rings in it. And there was only one way you were ever supposed to carry the ark, and that was that you put poles of acacia wood through there, and the priests were to put the ark on their shoulders and carry it places. Old school, not new technology. And what the priest knew is that you don't ever, 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 ever do something, and that's to touch the ark. See, they were forgetting to use their heads in worship, to think about what they were doing, to realize that this wasn't something you did. I mean, the crowd's so fired up, who cares? Let's just go. But this was not just a sweet religious observance that gave them a little sentimental buzz. This was not something that they did to cultivate positivity. This wasn't just like another gig they perform, right? No. They were dealing with something that had to be handled with care, but it gets worse because the oxen is pulling the cart along and the oxen stumbles, they're going downhill, and the ark begins to rock back and forth, and then this happens. We read it in verses 6 and 7. Verses 6 and 7. I'll read it from verses 6 and 7. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. Then the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. Wow, okay. So Uzzah was a Levite, a priest. And I'm sure if we stopped Uzzah right there and gave him a little theology exam and said, Uzzah, you're a Levite and you know you're never, 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 ever supposed to touch the ark, he would have said, I know, but oh my gosh, have you seen how many people are at church today? I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. And they're so excited about the Lord. And they're celebrating. And we've got a program to keep. And we don't want to lose momentum. We can't lose momentum. And God will understand. I mean, you don't want the thing to fall in the dirt. That would be a cringe moment. God did not understand. Uzzah made the arrogant assumption that the ark falling in the dirt was more of a cringe moment than a sinner touching something holy. God did not understand. They'd forgotten about the holiness of God. You know, I empathize with the Israelites because the Israelites were doing that day what we do with like our national holidays. They'd forgotten what they were doing and they'd forgotten who they were celebrating. You know, we have national holidays all the time. We have Memorial Day. We have Labor Day, we have Veterans Day, we have MLK Day. And isn't it so easy? Even Christmas, let me just pick on Christmas. Christmas is coming up and you're like me, you're going to go to this party and that party and do this event and do that event. And you can totally forget who it is you're celebrating and why you're doing it. Veterans Day is coming up. For most of us, let's be honest. Thank you if you serve. It's just a day off from work. We forget why we celebrate, and we forget who we're celebrating. And that's what they did. They had forgotten the gravity of what they're doing. They forgot the heart of what they were doing. They were very emotionally charged up, but they were going through the emotions of praise without giving thought to why. A lot of celebration, not any thought. They'd forgotten that God said, "I am holy, holy, holy. And you only worship me how I tell you to worship me. You don't freelance." Now, we're not very different. Because not only do we forget our holidays, we can treat our holy day the same way. We can treat Sunday like this. I mean, this is called the Lord's Day of the Ten Commandments that stand for... I mean, if you are designing 10 moral laws to keep the universe in check forever, how many of us would take one day to worship God and put it in there? That's probably the most forgotten of the commandments. I mean, many times we come to church, and it's a miracle if we make it at all, because there are a lot of things that compete with church. And if our family's still even on speaking terms by the time we get here, you know, plaster a fake smile on. You know, and we're often irregular in our gatherings for worship. I mean, gosh, sports stuff and other stuff. And we almost treat Sunday like it's an elective. And if the stars align, we go. And even when you say, okay, I'm really committed to the church, you know what it's like. You get involved volunteering here because you can't be part of South Point long and not volunteer. That's just the way it is. We're not a big church, so it's all hands on deck. But you can get involved here and do this and serve there and just forget what we're doing. What's the heart of the issue? What's the most important thing? I mean, why do we even come to church? Yes, we want to see friends. Yes, we want to make friends. Yes, we want our kids to have good influences so they don't go off the rails. But is that the main reason we come? You know, I want to hear music I like and hear something the preacher says that inspires me. All right, here's the heart of the matter. And I think this is where, again, this is one of those, it's like a holiday. We forget what and who. We don't come to church. You realize, you don't come to church. You are church. We come to worship. We come here once a week to come together to meet with the one who holds our eternal destiny in his hands, who holds the universe together, who holds our life and death in his hands, to ascribe to him honor. So a lot of times when we think about worship, I think we have it completely upside down. We've got it upside down here. We need to get it right side up. You've heard me say this in passing, but I want to unpack it a little bit. This is called a worship service, right? There's someone here who's being served. The highest priority of our service is to give God honor, to give God praise, to give God credit, to lean in faith, to be reminded of ultimacy, and to surrender our hearts anew. But a lot of times we come here and we're kind of critiquing. I like the music. No, I like the music. I like the way it's said. I don't like the way it says. What's the sermon? I don't know that sermon, you know. Let me tell you what it's like. I don't go to fine dining very much. It's a couple of reasons. Number one, I have thoroughly middle class taste buds. It's just lost on me a lot of times. And I live on a pastor's salary, so we don't get out to super nice places that much. But some years ago, I had heard about Cane Prime down in the Gulf. Anybody ever been to Cane Prime? Yes, I mean, it is not a cheap place to eat. I mean, you're talking $250 for a couple of people. And so, you know, we kind of scrimped and saved, and we had an anniversary or something. I don't even remember why we went. And we're going to go to Cane Prime. And all I heard about was, you got to get the filet, or if you're from Middle Georgia, the Philip Mignon, right? And I don't love anything like I love a medium rare Philip Mignon. I mean, that is like my thing. So, you know, we get there and we dress up. I've got a coat on and we're going to celebrate our love around great food and wine. And so can you imagine if we got there knowing I'm about to drop major coin on this meal? And we sit down and the waiter comes up and he sits down with us. Oh, I've never been here. Maybe this is the way they do things here. And he begins to talk about himself. Okay, I'm a pastor. I kind of like naturally gravitate to that. But then he puts his feet on the table. And after like 5 minutes have gone by and he's not taking my order, and I'm like, hey, aren't you here to do something? Aren't you supposed to be taking my order? You're going to get 20% of this. I mean, come on. You know, so many times I feel like we come to church and we're like that waiter. We're here to serve God primarily. But sometimes we kind of get sit at the table, put our feet up and say, okay, God, what you got for me today? We lose our heads in all the activities and all the enthusiasm. And sometimes, you know, the music isn't like we like it. The flow of worship isn't just like we had growing up. The sermon seems uninteresting. And so we respond with, what did you get out of church today? What did you get out of church today? Have you ever said that? What'd you get? What did you think about church today? Well, isn't the question, what did God think about your worship today? God didn't tolerate that from Uzzah. And so let me tell you what David did. David saw what happened and David freaked out. Wouldn't you freak out? David freaked out. He's like, I don't want to mess with this. Send it away. And some guy said, I guess you can put it in my garage. And then it said his house was blessed, you know. Well, some weeks later, David realizes, well, I can't do kingship without God. That doesn't work. So he invites it back. And so this is another worship service that we come across in verses 14 and 15. And this time, David is definitely using his head. And we see it in verses 14 and 15. He says, David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might. If you've seen the Richard Gere movie, King David, you remember this scene. While he and the entire house of Israel brought the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. Now, if the first portrait is of Uzzah losing his head in worship, the second person is of someone who lost their heart in worship. It was David's wife, Michal. Now, I talked about Michal last week and said she's a little bit of an exploited woman, and she was. But I just want you to know, never in the Bible is Michal ever flattered. The biblical writers don't like Michal. And so they called her Michal, daughter of Saul. That's kind of like calling somebody a really bad word. But we see her looking out the window at all that's going on. And this is what it says in verse 16. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, and that is a cut down, watched from a window. When she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. And then verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would. I mean, you can hear the sarcasm dripping out of there. And by the way, the ephod, he did not strip down. He did take off his kingly garment, and an ephod was a priestly garment, but it wasn't. It was slightly more than long johns, I'll put it that way. But she was embarrassed. She's looking at him. She's like, show some dignity, David. You're acting like an idiot here. You grow up. You remember who you are. People are watching. Have some self-respect. You know, David, you finally got a little bit of credibility in everybody's eyes. They made you the king. They don't throw it away through your silly, hokey religious displays. I'm glad we have the ark. I mean, I'm as religious as the next guy, but come on. This is more like watching a concert than actually participating in it. Michal was so concerned with what David was doing. so embarrassed at what David was doing, she stayed in her room. And she distanced herself from the blessing of God. Because if she would have given herself to worship, she would have been restored and renewed by God. Now, we're a Presbyterian church. Do you think we're more likely to err on the side of Uzzah, losing our heads? Or are we more likely to err on the side of Michael, losing our hearts? I think you know. We are terrified of losing our heads. We are so cognitive. It's almost like you got to have a graduate degree to even understand Presbyterianism. We're afraid of looking stupid or being over the top or expressing ourselves or being that guy who just, way too into it. We're afraid to lower our guard, to give God access to us so that we weep, to, as Rod reads the confession, to really let that drill down in our hearts. Maybe even to bow down on our knees. I mean, when's the last time you sang really loud? You know, we don't prepare our hearts to worship well. I think that's one place we really need to grow as a church. Preparing our hearts to worship. We all have a little bit of Michael in us. So we disengage, preserve our reputation. We observe worship, standing at a bit of a distance, instead of participating in it. Do you observe worship? Or do you participate in worship? You know, why do we do that? I think most of us are just kind of barely here. I mean, I'm very empathetic. I'm sometimes barely here. And we certainly probably all worry way too much about what people think about us. But I mean, how did God think about Michael? How did he feel about her refusal to engage? Well, this is what it says. It says, "And Michael, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death." Because God doesn't want us just to give him our heads. He wants us to give him our hearts. And if Uzzah lost his head in worship because of all the excitement, Michael lost her heart in worship because of her pride. But then we see David. David gave his head and David surrendered his heart. Jesus said we worship in spirit, our heart, and in truth, our head. How did David keep his head in worship? We see it in verse 21. Again, this marriage probably needed counseling. David said to Michael, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or you or anyone else from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people. And I will celebrate before the Lord." David knew exactly where he was. He knew exactly what he was doing and who he was doing it for. David says, there is one person I am performing for, and I'm on the stage for him. Now, let me tell you why it's a little more challenging in our worship service. I'm on the stage, aren't I? Brian and Becky and everybody, Ashley and Lori, they're on the stage. And so you feel like you're the audience. We're the performers. You're the audience. That's not right. You are not the audience. You're the congregation. We're not the performers. We are the prompters. Who's the audience? Who's getting served? God is the audience. And so there's someone watching. Our Creator, our Savior. So when you think about how was church today, I don't know, how did you do today? How did the one audience of your worship feel? Did you engage Him with your heart? Did you read and worship Him with your head? Did you give yourself to Him today? You see, David thought about what he was doing. He worshiped God. with his head, but he also worshiped God with his heart. Verse 22 says this, I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. In other words, he's like, Michael, I'm just getting going. If you thought that was a cringe moment, here we go. You know, let's just talk for a second. I want to conclude with just the how do you plan on worshiping? Do you plan on how you're going to engage God in worship when you come to church? You know, you probably do the same thing I often do. I plan very little, and if I plan anything, it's to do as little as possible. You know, most of us come to church honestly just wanting to be left alone. Let me go get my little religious deal and leave me alone. And there's a big difference between planning to do as little as possible versus planning to do as much as possible. You know, one of the things that's really impacted me is going on short-term mission trips. I've been all over the place, and, you know, a short-term mission trip, you get way more blessed and see more of God than anybody ever sees God or is blessed because you showed up. But there was one year in particular, I remember we went to a very small village on the side of a mountain outside of Mexico City, and it was a very, very impoverished village. They got power one day a week. And we had the privilege of staying with them in their homes as we were serving them, helping to build a church there. And I remember being, I mean, it's just to think about, it is a I'm in one room with like seven other people, and that's where we were for the week. And I remember the first night we talked about they were going to give us a feast. And, you know, it was stringy chicken and some sort of broth with a few tortillas. But the missionary said, hey, I want you to know they've been expecting you. And they've been saving their money for 4 weeks. And they've been going without even eating good stuff. And this is what they wanted to give you to honor you. And I literally remember being so incredibly humble and broken. And by the way, we made sure they got that money and more back. But they did it to honor us, to plan for it. And, you know, if you knew the Queen of England were coming to your home, to have a meal with you, I mean, would you get up off your couch when she knocked on the door and open the door in your sweatpants? Come on in. And like have a half-eaten jar of Jif peanut butter and a few salting crackers, say, make yourself at home? No. You would prepare. And so what happens is, because we don't prepare to worship well, we sort of get here whenever. And again, I'm not judging. Maybe I am. I'm not judging that hard. We get here when we can, if we get here at all. And a lot of times we show up to church, and what's the focus? Not the glory of God and how I worship, my personal needs. That's the focus. And what's the goal? My personal happiness. So let's just take a moment. As we gather for worship, and we'll respond in a moment in song, and again, it's not about how high you jump. It's about what's going on in your heart, spirit and in truth. But do you come to church with your personal needs as the focus and your personal happiness as the goal? And do you evaluate church by how you experienced it versus how you think God experienced your worship? Because, you know, it's in pouring out our soul to Him. That's how we're changed. It's in worship that we're changed. And so we got to safeguard God's truth. We're really good as Presbyterians at doing that. But the place we struggle is surrendering to God's Spirit. To say, Lord, I want to have an informed head and a surrendered heart. And Lord, I pray that you look at me as I worship. And you say, I'm receiving the reward of my suffering. A sinner whose tongue has been redeemed, singing praises to me. He's worthy. Let's pray.